This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 131 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderuff in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. All dug out, thankfully, from our blizzard over the weekend.
Well, that's good to hear. That's good to hear. You got kind of hammered with that.
So before we get started, I want to congratulate my co-host for being in Drone Magazine from the UK, Volume 2, which was January 2016. And Max gave a lovely article and was fortunate, and I get to go for a ride because we're the cover photograph, but really nice article, Max. Congratulations. I love your podcasting tips. I'm glad you do them and I don't have to.
Yeah, this article was called Radioactivity, and it was about drone podcasts. And the magazine is relatively new. I guess you could figure that out from episode 2. I think episode...
You mean volume 2, episode 2? The magazines don't come in episodes, Matt.
I'm used to podcasts, aren't I? Issue 2, sorry. Issue 2. And in the U.S., I know you can find them at the Barnes & Noble bookstores, probably some others as well. So
call ahead at Barnes & Noble. There wasn't a Barnes & Noble in the area that carried it for me. So you lucked out, Max, because I couldn't find them in five Barnes & Nobles in the Philadelphia area.
And I bought all the ones from the Barnes & Noble near us. So, no, not really.
Well, this is great, but we've got a guest tonight, so which is a nice change of pace. We'd like to welcome Jonathan Evans. He's the CEO of Skyward. Jonathan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Now, let's talk about Skyward for just a second before we launch. Skyward provides professional services for commercial UAV businesses. That can be software in the form of airspace maps and integrated flight planning tools, kind of a variety of different services and products. We'll be talking about those. But Jonathan is a professional pilot, flew for, 18 years? Is that in the commercial arena?
Yeah, actually, started the aviation journey as a private pilot when I was enlisted in the Army at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And I kind of spent all my free time and my meager paycheck as a private in the Army, getting my private pilot license at a 2,700 foot grass strip, called Vine Grove, Kentucky. And I learned in, a 172, like a lot of us do, and took some of those first, wonderful steps into the sky. I ended up getting picked up, for flight school in the Army, very fortunately, and, spent the next really 7 years and change, flying predominantly the UH-60 Blackhawk, which was, just a great pleasure, and a lot of fun. I'm not going to lie. I did my first tour in Germany at the 236 Medical Company, in Landstuhl, Germany. Did about 6 months in Kosovo, as a medevac pilot, young, I think I was 21 or 22, year old co-pilot, medevac dust-off pilot, we call it, and then did my second tour in D.C. as a VIP pilot, flying sometimes below 200 feet on the Potomac River, actually, up and down and connecting some of the folks that were running the show in D.C. for a while.
Some of the prettiest Blackhawks available to the Army.
Oh, you've seen them. Yeah, the limos, we called them. the black and gold limo. And they have, I'm told, NASA memory foam seats in the back, too, that really were quite nice. Very nice, yes.
I'm sure. Well, yeah. Jonathan, you've been involved in and following the unmanned aviation sector for a few years now here. Can you tell us, just overall, where do you think the unmanned industry stands right now?
Well, I tell you, I think we're really at a democratizing moment of the technology. We were just talking before the podcast, guys, about how, you know, just 3 years ago, it was a tough conversation to have about drones because people really only pictured one thing, you know, the Predator. And it really serving overseas and in a military capacity. And I said, you know, I think the military is a really tough brand ambassador for a really elegant and new technology here in aerial robotics or drones. And I think we're at that moment, much like the internet and sort of DARPANET coming out of the military. You know, when DARPANET became the commercial internet that we all are empowered by today. I think we're at a very similar inflection point with the technology, where it's well established that it's out of the military context at this point, and it's into a commercial context. And now I think we're starting to see that that moment of inflection where it's truly becoming democratized. And so, you know, we all know that for $1,000 or even less now, we can put a gyro-stabilized 4K camera in the sky, you know, out of the box, and we can order that box overnight from Amazon today. So that ability to take to the sky and to start really adding value there, providing services, providing all kinds of services in a commercial environment is right where we are. And, you know, the FAA just reached out to all of the recreational drone pilots out there, the hobbyists that are getting these things under their Christmas trees and ordering them online. And they said, hey, register. And within a month, 300,000 people had registered. And we have more, you know, really unmanned aircraft in the sky already, I think, we're approaching, than there are manned aircraft. And that's an exciting time in history.
I didn't really think that that many people were going to register that quickly. I don't know what number I would have predicted, but it would have been a lot smaller than that.
Yeah, and I think it's just a leading indicator too.
Right.
I mean, who knows what it's a representation of? It looks a lot to me like the Apple IIe moment, really. You know, where this technology is truly getting in the hands of people in their homes and in their schools, you know, and in their places of work. And it's not what are these things going to do, it's what are they not going to do. I think within 10 years, we will all touch this technology, you know, this aerial robotic network that we're going to be very rapidly evolving towards on a day-to-day basis. I don't think it'll be one-to-one. I don't think we'll all have a little Tinkerbell drone following us personally around or anything like that. But I do think we'll touch the technology as often as we touch our cell phones.
It's funny because Max is always using the word disruptive technology. When we started this path 131 episodes ago, we were like, we don't know where it's going. We don't know what it's capable of doing. And we're always kind of surprised at when people come up with new and creative things. It's like, oh, wow, they're doing that with that? That's pretty neat. I would have never thought of that, but that's why I'm doing a podcast and not inventing drone software.
Yeah, I think it's very hard to predict, you know, where we'll be even in 12 months, let alone in 24 months or 5 years or 10 years. I think the only thing that is certain is that it's going to be a lot different than it is today. Jonathan, what do you think are some of the big challenges as this industry, as this concept of unmanned aircraft moves forward? What are the things that we need to be looking at or thinking about? What are the big risks?
Well, I tell you, coming at the problem, I guess, of shepherding forward this technology as a professional pilot, and particularly as a helicopter pilot, where I spend a lot of my career in this low integrated urban airspace, landing and taking off of rooftops in city environments. This is where the drones are, right? This democratized technology. That infrastructure is robust. You know, and it's the infrastructure of safety that we trust when we walk down a jetway, all of us instinctually, right? The National Airspace System is really quite bulletproof. It's the envy of other transportation systems, right, in terms of a safety record. And I think the challenge and what we went after at Skyward and really focused on is providing a simplicity to access that robustness. You know, it's not to take away the complexity of the National Airspace System, but it's to simplify that complexity and make it more accessible to, honestly, a new generation of aviator that is now taking to the skies that isn't going to go through the same apprenticeship that I or any of the other professional pilots at Skyward have gone through. And I think that that is one of the biggest challenges. And you know, I dare say we're solving that for many commercial operators around the world now. We're helping to simplify that complexity without removing any of the robustness of the aviation infrastructure that makes that, you know, that social contract so safe up there in the sky.
Well, before we talk about that in a little bit more detail, maybe, Jonathan, tell us, how did you personally get involved in going down this path? What drew you to this? How did you get involved in it?
Well, so I was literally, you know, after the Army, I ended up doing a couple entrepreneurial things. And then I, you know, ended up flying again at one point, and that was great. And I was literally, you know, on duty as a life flight pilot in Eugene, Oregon, you know, really just surfing the internet and reading everything I could about drones, about what I really started to come to see as aerial robotics. And it just was this really sort of perfect confluence or nexus of my two passions, just as a person. I'm, you know, the kid who was looking at the sky, you know, from a very young age and wanting to be a pilot. And I was very fortunate to get to fulfill that dream. But, you know, was always just an aviation geek at heart. And this continues that passion. But, you know, as I became a little bit more awake in the world, I realized that the whole computer science, information science, networked information science was really one of the most fascinating, deep, and interesting things in the world to me. And my additional duties as an Army pilot were always as a network administrator and building databases and doing what I could to kind of immerse in that. So I've always been kind of a geeky pilot, and aerial robotics are really, you know, they're the confluence of those two technological histories of aviation and computer and information science itself.
Jonathan, you're coming from this from as a pilot, and you're talking about simplifying things. Do you think we'll be able to successfully integrate people who aren't pilots and are coming at this technology from a different facet than someone who's actually flown in the national airspace? Because the majority of the people who are actually flying UAVs or small UASs aren't pilots.
Yeah, sure. That's a really good question. I think that from the outset, I just want to say, and I think that the FAA was very clear in saying in a very positive voice this winter with the registration effort for recreational drone pilots. And yeah, I paused there to say pilots, you know, that everybody needs to register their aircraft and join a culture of accountability that is basically, you know, the heritage we're shepherding forward as pilots. You know, there's an accountability to taking to the sky and a great responsibility for it. And I don't think that there's anything different about that for this generation. And I think that what is the, you know, the apprenticeship to becoming a pilot is going to be, you know, increasingly collapsed more and more into something that's accessible and easy, but still just as responsible for taking to the sky. So I do think that this is the positive direction, and that Part 107, the rules that are posited by the FAA right now that we should see hopefully this summer promulgated, that allows for commercial drone operations in the national airspace system, that inherits this tradition of it having to go through you know, an education to understand the rules of the road of the airspace that you're joining. And, you know, there's a syllabus, a training syllabus in Part 107 that says you have to understand at a bare minimum things like the airspace that you're joining and what the expectations are in that airspace of the other aviators that you're now sharing that airspace with as, yes, a pilot, even though a ground-based one.
So tell us how Skyward fits in. What's the solution, or what's the value that Skyward is trying to bring?
Well, you know, I see this, I've referred to it already, you know, as a new generation of aviators. They're very, very pioneering. There are a lot of businesses out there right now that are new kinds of businesses, new kinds of value and services added to businesses all over the country. And what we provide these aviation pioneers are a set of tools that they need to manage those businesses. And we're not just talking about sort of, you know, moms and pops and, you know, the democratized side of the technology. We're also talking about enterprises that are starting to stand up their nascent and early programs in aerial robotics. And we provide these professional drone operators a set of tools, a set of operational management tools that are cloud-based and also, you know, pushed out to the endpoints we expect in our mobile and offline environments. And so specifically, you know, these tools take the form of, we have a drone airspace map that tells people where it's safe to fly and where they need to maybe coordinate to fly. And where, you know, quite honestly, there are places that you shouldn't fly, like inside of a temporary flight restriction that's put up around a forest fire. We also provide flight planning and logging tools, which are, you know, those are the basic units of measure of any professional aviation operation. Is you need to plan your flights and associate pilots and machines and aircraft with them. And you need to also log those flights. And you need to be able to show a record of what you did with those aircraft and those pilots. And we provide all this in a digital system of record. And we back it all up with a team of experts that has filed, you know, dozens of Section 333 applications and produced dozens of operating manuals and safety manuals and maintenance procedures to help stand up these professional drone businesses. And then using the Skyward software as a workflow in that new kind of business, you pick up compliance as a matter of workflow. And that's what I mean by simplifying without losing any of the robustness of the aviation infrastructure that that we all enjoy today.
Yeah, I've played around a little bit with the online version, the trial version of the flight logging system, and it's fairly interesting. You get to specify the drones that you have, the aircraft that you have, things like the batteries that you have, so you can, you know, track that as well. It's kind of an interesting interface that's sort of easy to use and stores all of this in the cloud, I guess you say, correct?
That's right. I mean, it starts as a cloud-based system, and then we're actually going to be releasing a mobile app soon as well, that where you can take all of that information and you can move it to, you know, a mobile environment that we all expect in our pockets these days, but most importantly, to an offline environment. You know, we've found that a great majority of our commercial drone operators, our customers out there, are flying in offline environments. They're flying in offline environments sometimes because they're turning off their cell phones so that they can decrease any kind of RF interference with their drone. So, you know, this offline component is fundamental when you're talking about critical, you know, aviation safety information. And so that's part of the Skyward platform as well. That's coming here very soon.
Because you're dealing with commercial users, commercial operations, I'm curious as to what types are showing up more often in the landscape of things. I mean, we talk about things like structure inspections, precision agriculture. I mean, there's so many different areas where these things can bring great value. Is there a way to characterize where you're seeing the action these days?
Yeah, I mean, sure. There are sort of large verticals that, you know, that we they're kind of the usual suspects at point that, you know, at this point in kind of these discussions, right? We've got videography. We work with clients in professional sports that are using videography in a very active way for, you know, filming their practices and giving coaches real-time data access. So it kind of takes a step beyond videography. You know, there's low-hanging fruit. There's real estate, you know, and you can see more and more shots from above, you know, the aerial perspective getting truly yes. democratized across the MLS, you know. But, you know, you've got also high-end videography. You can see more and more in commercials. You can see that Hollywood is really taking to the sort of sky jib. Those things are all experiencing a lot of velocity, I think, in commercial application right now. But yeah, the industrial inspection that you were talking about, tower inspections, those are the places where we're really seeing now enterprise level applications. Those are places where you can start to see multipliers, network effects taking place, where these nascent fleets and these nascent services that are really geared towards providing a service level to an enterprise customer are really reaching a market viability right now that I think you're going to see in this year and the next commercial drone applications take to scale in places like cell phone tower inspections. You know, there are hundreds of thousands of cell phone towers across this country, and they have, you know, a pretty stringent and well-established and certificated inspection requirement that drones can take care of, you know, at least a third of at this point right now. If you look at large infrastructure like pipelines and utility power lines and places that cover hundreds and thousands of miles, there are some very clear applications there for beyond visual line of sight, you know, sort of riskless airspace, rural airspace applications that I think you'll see come online here very soon with, you know, neighbors like we have out the gorge here in Oregon and Hood River in In-Situ. In-Situ is doing some interesting work with BNSF railroads right now down in New Mexico. And I think you'll see things like that start to take a lot more traction as well.
Interesting.
Do you think regulation will be a hindrance, or do you think we're going to get practical regulation so that the scalability will accelerate, or do you think it'll hold steady, or that niche, you know, we're always worried about what's the FAA going to do? Do you think we're going to find scalability in the next year?
You know, I think that's sort of the dance of technological progress and in history in general. Honestly, it's that innovation leads regulation. It always does, because, you know, that we have to first have the public imagination of this thing before we want to facilitate it. Honestly, I think of a four-way intersection in the automobile. You know, at first we have automobiles arriving at a four-way intersection with no markings at all, and just a sort of understood and maybe least efficient social contract to take turns and pass through the four-way intersection. And then the policy comes in to put a stop sign there. You know, and the stop sign goes up, and that actually increases the efficiency of being able to move this technology through this four-way intersection. And then, you know, you get the stop light and you get a certain algorithmic sort of optimization that's taking place there, to the point that now we arrive at a series of stop lights of four-way intersections that are, you know, programmatically designed to optimize the traffic flow across that entire lane of travel. And that's that dance, right? We increase the speed of cars. We need to have more efficient ways of getting through that four-way intersection. And the policy and the regulation kind of holds that technology in a way that should enable it, you know, and make it better. And I think that's what aviation regulations do too. I've always felt empowered by them. I think it's kind of a great conundrum of aviation where, you know, we have that sort of, it was established well before Maverick, actually by Tom Wolfe and the Right Stuff, right? But the aviation swagger is this sort of cowboy, this Maverick, right? And it's this great adventurer, really, right? This heart of, you know, like this lusty heart of an adventurer is this aviator. But the conundrum is that the way you access that capability, the way you become a pilot, is through this great litany of rules. Being shepherded through an apprenticeship of being disciplined to following those rules. Here I am at the the hopefully midpoint of a wonderful career flying from the flight deck, and the more things I learn and the more disciplines I take to conforming to really a set of rules, the more access I get to that sky and more interesting machines. And I kind of think drones and aerorobotics are just the latest ticket I'm punching off and taking the discipline to do so right now.
Now, you have a webinar that's coming up February 16th, I understand. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. Well, we've got some great guests that are coming to share with us their expertise. They're professional drone operators out there in the field making real businesses in this right now. Of course, they're using Skyward. And we're fortunate to be joined by Tom Hallman, who's formerly of PictorVision, John Altwerther of Arobo, and David Day of Keystone Aerial Services. And they're going to talk about their success in the drone industry and what they've learned along the way. So, you know, opening will be a sort of introduction to them and the Skyward Professional Services team that supports them. And then really we'll open it up to all of you folks out there to hear what are your questions. what does it take to run a professional drone business these days? There are a lot of hard questions. And as I've been saying, you know, we aim to make the sky accessible to you and to try to simplify some of that complexity.
That's great. And we'll put a link in the show notes to the page where folks can register for the webinar. Also, the website skyward.io, that's probably the best place for folks to go who want to learn more.
That's right. That's a great spot. You could also follow us on Twitter, I'm sure. And I'm on there too at JWCE21.
All right, David. Hey, we've got a couple of news items that I think Jonathan might be able to comment on.
Let's talk about Lufthansa swoops on drone market. This was from DW.com, and we also got one from China Daily on the same story. DJI and Lufthansa have signed a partnership deal because they want to be a one-stop shop, according to the articles. Lufthansa Aerial Services, LAS, would use DJI products to provide commercial services to customers, kind of like Lufthansa doing their air catering. They're just spinning it off, and they're taking advantage of their infrastructure to leverage drones. This kind of thing seems to be starting to become more and more common that our big mainstream stuff, Jonathan, is trying to get their foot in the door and trying not to get behind the curve, I guess you would say.
Yeah, I think that's great. Honestly, I do. I think this is a really nice partnership. I was excited to read about it, honestly, because DJI are, you know, they're the ones producing that Apple IIe right now. These guys are shipping a really, you know, an excellent product and at that democratized level right now. And they're really going to be benefited by having a partnership with a stakeholder like Lufthansa in the airspace, honestly. You know, they have, you said the word infrastructure. They represent a deep heritage of aviation infrastructure. And I think they're only going to be able to improve the DJI offering and really improve aerial robotics as a whole that way, again, at that sort of democratized level. And you're right. You look at it from the Lufthansa lens. It's a very innovative move on their part. And, you know, we work with quite a few what we'll just call sort of aviation constituents right now as well. There's a real vision in those well-established institutions of aviation that I think you're going to see evolve in moves like this from Lufthansa and others in this year and in the coming years ever increasingly. Because, you know, really, it is about providing a set of professional aviation services. These are, you know, fleets of aircraft, and they're the most sophisticated fleets we've seen yet. So it makes sense that, you know, those channels of, you know, aviation heritage would flow into these new pathways.
Another item, we heard from our friend Bob Schmidt from UAV Propulsion Tech, who we should mention, of course, is a sponsor of the show, and they posted on their site, a white paper by Sarah Vallely from MicroPilot. And she talks about some considerations for open source software. If you listen to our last episode, I was waxing enthusiastic about the Drone Code project and open source control software for UAVs. And in this piece, Vallely argues that, well, there's some problems with open source software, and those being things like the quality, sustainability, or the support that you might get or that might evaporate over time, and describes a little different approach, an open architecture approach, which is what MicroPilot uses. Unlike open source software, where the source code is publicly available, an open architecture approach, the core, in this case, Autopilot, is closed source, so you don't have access to it, but they provide hooks, or you can develop custom plugins, let's say, that let you interact with the proprietary core. So it's an interesting article. We'll put a link to this in the show notes, of course. I don't know, Jonathan, do you have any thoughts on sort of the open source concept for providing the core control systems for unmanned aircraft?
That's a really good question. I'm glad you guys brought this one up. I'll be totally honest. I didn't read this article, but I'm going to. It sounds like a really interesting discussion. I definitely have a few thoughts on that. I was glad to hear, as I was sort of formulating as you were telling me the beginning of the story, I was glad to hear that it arrived at that distinction between an open architecture environment and an open source environment. I think that the open source tome can kind of get punted around almost like a football in this space sometimes, and it's not a binary. You know, there is an entire continuum here of what we mean by open architectures, you know, and open source being sort of the maybe, you know, one of the dipoles of that spectrum. I think that absolutely we need to lever the capabilities of integrated and open architectures to enable this ecosystem. I think that is the way of the best platform development architectures in the modern world. And I think that is the way of this one. I do think that we need a certain amount of focus in that open environment, in that collaborative environment. I think we need a certain amount of regulatory tension, honestly. I think we need a little bit of that public social contract tension to how we form those standards, those interoperable standards. And I can say that, you know, the best work I see being done there is the work that we're, you know, very grateful to join at the table at NASA UTM. Nice. And we get to work with partners like Google and Amazon there to talk about, you know, technical standards of interoperability. And the nice thing about it being, you know, at NASA, and you know, these are standards like the way we set up the registry system for the internet, right? It was distributed and interoperable and a set of architectures that anybody could build from and yet conform to a set of standards that we can all count on and be able to send, you know, emails across the world to each other now, right? It's that kind of architecture. It's sort of a headless distributed architecture, but it's just as robust, right? It's just as robust as if you have, for example, DOT just hosting a database where, you know, you register. You know, if you have a distributed registration system, it's a lot more robust, actually, a lot safer, and it speaks to cybersecurity concerns. And that's the kind of thing that we advocate for through, you know, NASA UTM, where we can bring the industry together to talk about technical standards of interoperability that have, you know, that government lens to them, so that it's still the national airspace system that's regulated, but can evolve at the speed of technological change, basically. And I think that that's a really good forum for a technocratic solution to the way, you know, we can understand how to communicate where vehicles from two different companies are in the air, for example, right? That's the kind of rule that this boils down to. And that's going to be a digital rule. That's going to be a technological rule. And we want the government to say there should be one. And then we want to have basically a technical standards body that says, here is what the latest snapshot of that technical rule looks like.
Right, right. Yeah, it's fascinating to me because we like to talk about this as being a brand new industry that's just emerging, and we have all of these issues that need to be resolved. But so many of them, and as you point out, Jonathan, so many of them have analogies to other things that have gone before it, that in a way we've already solved most of these problems in other contexts in the past, and we can learn from those, and we can, you know, draw on those to solve the, you know, the current version of the same problem in this industry. So yeah, it's fascinating stuff.
Well, I tell you, if I could riff off of that for a second, you know, that's where we're headed with Skyward. That's our big vision, right? Is we want to introduce a context to airspace access that's very similar to what we expect from, you know, Verizon in our cell phones. You know, the FCC is providing a regulated common good that is this bandwidth. You know, the bandwidth is a public regulated good that the set of rules it takes to navigate that bandwidth are basically passed through these telcos like Verizon, and then they're passed to us as a commercial service. You know, none of us need ham radio operators licenses anymore to text when we transmit and receive right, on that publicly regulated bandwidth. And we want to bring, you know, again, the same robustness of aviation infrastructure, but we want to collapse it to that kind of simplicity, where, you know, a Skyward enabled drone will have access to the sky for whatever you want it to do, and we'll navigate the rules of the road as a matter of being on the Skyward network.
All right. Well, David, we're kind of running short on time here, but you did find a pretty impressive video of the week.
I did, and I'd like to thank Facebook for posting this, for showing up in my feed. But this actually is from the Drone Racing League, the DRL, and it's first-person view, and it's drone racing around Miami Dolphins Stadium, and make it widescreen and do it before you eat your lunch. It's pretty impressive.
It is.
And it's surprisingly cool. And I was really sort of surprised when it ducked into the inside of the stadium, and part of the course was inside the stadium instead of just so. It's pretty self-explanatory, but like I said, if you're kind of queasy about these kind of things, I would say watch it before you eat.
Okay. One of the interesting things about what the DRL, the Drone Racing League, is doing is that if you've watched FPV drone racing in the past, like, for example, the championships were held, I think that was in California that we talked about some months ago, the resolution was pretty poor. And that's because if you put an HD camera on a drone and then send that signal back, it's too delayed for the pilot to be useful. So in the past, we've been sort of stuck with this low-def video. Well, what the DRL is looking to do is actually put two cameras on each of the racing drones, one for the pilot to use, and that'd be the low-res real-time view, and then another HD camera that would be used not to broadcast the racing live, but something that the producers could then use to edit and package up a video of the event that spectators, us, online, would watch at a later time. So interesting tack. We'll put obviously a link to the video in the show notes, also a link to the Drone Racing League website. They've got a schedule set up, a lot of races planned for 2016, and this will be, I think, some great watching. Well, I think with that, we need to bring this to a close. We want to thank our guest, Jonathan Evans, the CEO of Skyward. Find them at skyward.io. Again, Jonathan, thanks so much.
Hey, this was a lot of fun, guys. Thanks. Anytime.
We may call you up and bring you back.
You get worried when they say they want to come back. We must be doing something wrong, man.
Oh, you guys are my kind of geeky pilots, I tell you.
We love this stuff.
Yeah.
We want to thank all of you for listening. This has been episode 131. Find us at the UAVdigest.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, which will include, again, a link to that webinar coming up in February. I think I'm going to have to sign up for that myself. That link will be in the show notes as well. That's at the UAVdigest.com/131. Of course, we're all over social media. David, you want to tell everybody where they can find us?
Well, they can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest, on Facebook at facebook.com/UAVDigest. And how do you want to help the show? Well, there's multiple ways you can do it. You can leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher.com. You can always get some swag from our Cafe Press store, or you can become a patron of the show at patreon.com. And all of those links you can find on our homepage, which is theuavdigest.com. So I guess with that, we'll say have a good week. And this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.